Hello again, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in this week to the Good Cheer program. I'm Chauncey Griffith, and I'm so glad to have you along. Hey, this week and every week, the Good Cheer program is brought to you in part by the Kentucky National Guard. Text KYGUARD to 95577 to join, or for more information about the Kentucky National Guard. And as always, let's make sure we remember them in our thoughts and our prayers. And we're so thankful for the Kentucky National Guard for not only sponsoring this program, but for doing what they do, because without them and fine men and women like the Kentucky National Guard, we would not be able to be here doing what we're doing. And they're a huge blessing to us, no doubt about it. Hey, I hope you're having a great week. I know I sure am. I say it every week, and I mean it every week. You know, I wanted to start out. I read a devotional the other day that it stuck with me. There's a few things I'm going to talk about on the program this week that been running through my mind, a couple songs, and this devotional, I read it the other day, and it talked about seeing God in our everyday life, in just whatever we do throughout the day, noticing God, noticing the little things. You know, it's easy to coast through our life, just kind of like we're on our own. Sometimes we have a tendency to maybe forget about God in certain situations when we're really busy or when we have a lot going on. But we know that in order to grow our relationship with God and build a firm foundation and build upon that firm foundation, it's important to be intentional, and it's important to seek God and notice Him in everything we do, every moment. Matthew 6:33 says, "But seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." Now, seeking God, that's like an action. That we'll talk more about action later on too. But actively seek God. Look for Him. Even if we're just walking down the street, look for the things, the beautiful stuff that God's made. When we're with our family or our friends, we're supposed to thank God for putting those people in our life. I know I can count a bunch of people that I'm so thankful God put in my life, and He's just adding more and more every day. And it's also important that we stay in prayer. When life's good and things are going well, whether you're doing good at your job or you ace a test at school or whatever it happens to be, rejoice in the Lord. Thank Him for the blessings in your life, whether they're big or small. And on the flip side of that, when the opposite happens and when times are tough, you know, it's kind of like the God in the mountain and is the same as the God in the valley. We know that song. We're supposed to pray to God and ask Him for help in those bad times, in those tough times. If we lean on God and ask Him to help us get through these tough times, He'll guide our path. The Bible says so. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all ways acknowledge Him, and He will make straight your paths." And after all, each and every one of us can see, if we just open our eyes, we can see how God's moved in our life. It could be changes that we see in our life, or like I said, meeting new people, finding new friends, preparing to graduate this time of year. I teach school at Boyd County High School in Ashland, Kentucky. It's that time of year. It's graduation time. Maybe we're looking for a new job. Whatever it is we're going through, we should notice what God's doing for us and how He's doing it. He gives us plenty of opportunities and takes them away for a reason, either to strengthen us or help us, but we should notice what He's doing and thank Him for it. Right back in Proverbs 3, this is verses 9 and 10. It says, "Honor the Lord with your wealth and with the first fruits of all your produce. Then your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will be bursting with wine." I just felt like sharing that right here at the beginning of the program this week. I hope it's a blessing to somebody. Seek God. I guarantee this. Whether you're in good times or bad times, seeking God is a good thing. No question about that. And speaking of a good thing, we all know this. You're happy when you're laughing. And here's Mark Bishop.
This is Mark Bishop, and you're happy when you're laughing. Brother Luther at church is always telling me stories, and I don't know if he's telling the truth or not. He was telling me about his cousin Agnes, and he said, "She told me she didn't want any of the men in the church to be pallbearers at her funeral. She said, relatives are okay, but I don't want the men from the church to be pallbearers at my funeral. I said, good night, Agnes. Why don't you want the men at the church to be pallbearers? She said, they wouldn't take me out when I was alive. I don't want them to take me out when I'm dead." I said, "Brother Luther, you just made that up." He said, no. "Agnes is a good woman. We bought her a bed skirt for her birthday one year, and it fit her real well." I said, "Brother Luther, you've made that up." He said, "My wife said we ought to go back to Walmart and get her the matching curtains and pillow shams sometime before Christmas so she can match her bedroom." I just gave up.
You know, I think if I had to give one word as a theme or a summary, I don't know what you call it, but one word to describe the Bible, it would be the word love. L-O-V-E, love. There's so many verses that talk about God's love or, you know, the love that he had to send his one and only son to this earth to die for the sins of everyone who would believe in him and give them opportunity to spend eternity in heaven with him, or how Jesus commands us to love one another. One of my favorite verses about love is 1 John 4:19. It says, "We love because he first loved us." That's a simple, concise verse, and I think it's a pretty awesome one. But it summarizes a whole lot. It's short, but it's in-depth in the same aspect. Anyway, that's not what I wanted to talk about. I just, the word love, so many of us believe and sometimes teach that love is a feeling or an emotion. And yeah, it does involve feelings and emotions, but the greatest part of love is an action word. It's a verb, you know, like something you do. There's a whole lot of marriages out there, even among Christian people, that are failing because they value feelings over actions. You know, you hear people say they fell out of love, but really there is no falling out or falling into love. You can fall out of the bed or fall out of the bathtub, but typically we grow to love somebody over time. And this love for one another grows from what we see people do for us or do for other people. It's an action. Now think about this. Imagine if Jesus Christ, just before the cross, went to the garden and thought, "I hate this feeling. I don't like this. Therefore, I'll base my decision on what I feel." What if that would have happened? If he based what he did on a feeling? If that had happened, we'd all be hopelessly doomed. None of us would make it to heaven, that's a guarantee. But the good news is that Jesus resisted when he did have that feeling, and he fought back against his feelings, and even though he prayed 3 times to have the cup removed, he was more interested in doing the will of the Father than doing what he felt like doing. I'm thankful for that, no doubt about that. Now, Jesus, he displayed his love, or he acted out his love, you know, that verb, love. He did it by going to the cross and dying for everybody. He died for the ones who supported him and loved him and followed him. He also did it for the sinners, and he did it for those who were still his enemies and the wicked people, the people who hung him on the cross. So I guess to summarize my thought here, we've got to know that love's not dependent on feelings and emotions, because just look around. Feelings are one of the shallowest and most unreliable of all human emotions. Got a whole lot of people acting on feelings. Instead, we as Christians, we've got to emphasize that love is a choice. It's not really a feeling, because feelings are subjective, while love is objectively displayed in our actions. Bottom line, love is what a person chooses to do, not what a person chooses to feel. Remember John 3:16, God so loved the world because he felt like it. Well, wait a minute now, he did feel like it, and he does love us, but that love required action, and that included the supreme, indescribable sacrifice that he gave, and that was his only son's life. That was the ultimate love in action. And when it comes to that word love, don't forget, Jesus said in John 15:12-13, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends." I think of it like this. The opposite of love is not hatred, because in hatred there's at least some emotions. The opposite of love is indifference. If we're supposed to show God's love and teach about God's love and display God's love in the world, we got to focus on what God does more than what God feels. Not that God doesn't feel love for us, but God feeling love for us wasn't enough to save us. It was God's love that cost Jesus his life. And it's our job to acknowledge that cost that he paid with the desire that we'll love one another just as Christ loved us. Just wanted to share that this week. And that brings me to our first song of the program. A couple weeks ago, my father-in-law Richard and my Nan, we went to a concert at the Paramount Arts Center in Ashland, Kentucky. It was Gold City and the Inspirations Quartet and the Primitive Quartet, who we've had a couple of them. We had Reagan Riddle and Mike Riddle here on the program. But they sing a song. Reagan Riddle wrote this one. It's called Three Little Words. And the way he wrote these lyrics, I think it's genius. But listen to the words and think about what's being said here. This one goes out to my mom, Robin Griffith. Back after this on the Good Cheer program.
I don't say them enough, and I'm not
even really sure why. 'Cause they describe how I feel about the ones I hold dear in my life. Just three little words, but they're mighty when used, and I need to use them today. So to my wife and my kids, my family and friends, there's something that I want to say. Oh, I love you. I want you to know it today. Yes, I love you. It's a privilege for me to say how much you mean to me. You are precious indeed. So from my heart, sincerely, oh, I love you. Not telling those whom you love. You say they know how I feel, so there's no need to say it that much. But there may come a day you would give anything if you could have just one more chance to pull them up close and say these three words. You better do it while you can be heard. Oh, I love you. Someone died on a cross on a hill so far away, so that I could reach God when I kneel down to pray. Lord, I love you. I want you to know it today. Yeah. It's a privilege for me to say how much you mean to me. You are precious indeed. So from my heart, sincerely, Lord, I love you.
Hey, I didn't mention in the opening of the show, but I hope everyone listening had a great Easter. Coming off of Easter Sunday, and what a time to just reminisce and be thankful for that sacrifice, that immeasurable sacrifice we talked about a little bit earlier. You know, because without that sacrifice, there would be no Christian church, first of all, and we wouldn't have the opportunity to spend eternity in heaven. And actually, I wanted to share something about the resurrection, about the tomb, and Jesus rising on the third day, something I learned this year that I had never really thought that in depth about. I was actually talking with Teresa Kazee. She was the counselor at Cannonsburg Elementary when I went to elementary school. I go to church with her. She's awesome. And she was talking about this, and I've kind of looked into it a little bit since then because it kind of piqued my interest. And I wanted to share it here on the program, but I wanted to give Miss Kazee a shout out for even bringing it up to me. In the book of John, when it talks about Peter, Simon Peter, arriving at the tomb, he went in and saw the burial cloth there, the stuff that Jesus had been wrapped in, and then the cloth that they had laid over his face or his head, it wasn't with the burial cloth, but it was rolled up kind kind of folded up over in a separate place. Now, the question is, why is that significant? Never really thought about it before, but why would John have noted the placement of the burial cloths in light of the astonishing fact that Jesus was gone, his body was absent? And even more astonishing than that, why would he have thought it was important to include this detail in the telling of the events on that first Easter Sunday morning? Well, come to find out, it was very important. It's very significant, and there's a reason why. According to Jewish tradition, the rolling up and the placement of that cloth or that napkin, it was a Jewish custom at the time. It related to a common practice used by servants and by masters of this area. After a servant had prepared the dining table for his master, he would stand to the side, out of sight, you know, over out of the way, but he was watching, being attentive to the progression of the meal, waiting until everybody got done eating. And he wouldn't dare return to the table until the master had finished his meal. We know how that goes. But when the master, who was sitting there eating, when he had finished the meal, he would stand up, clean his fingers and his mouth and all that, his beard, with his napkin or his cloth, and he would crumple it up on the table in a ball. And that meant if he crumpled it up like that and threw it down, that meant I finished, I'm done. But for whatever reason, if the master left the table with the intention of returning, or hey, I want some more, whatever it is, I'm coming back to sit here, then he would crease the napkin into folds and leave it beside his dishes so he'd fold it up neatly. And what this meant was, hey, I'll be back, don't disturb the table, I'm returning. Now, knowing that, maybe that's the reason why John thought it was important to talk about that cloth that was over Jesus' face. Jesus had told Simon Peter and all of his disciples, I'll be back. The Son of Man will return. And that morning, with that napkin, that cloth, he was repeating his promise. It was a seemingly inconsequential gesture, but it was very symbolic, leaving his face cloth rolled up, folded up to the side, assuring that he'd not left for good. I thought that was really interesting. I'd never heard that before, and I thought maybe somebody out there might be interested. John 14, 27 and 28 says, do not let your hearts be troubled or afraid. You heard me tell you, I'm going away, but I will come back to you.
I won't forget the night I stepped out of my pew. Walked down the aisle, my running days were through. I knelt at the altar just as I am. Gave my life to the Father and left a brand new man. Now I'm a member of the lost and found. The Lord took his pen and wrote my name down.
That was Southbound with a song called Lost and Found. I really enjoy that one. Hey, my Sunday school lesson this past week, we're running low on time, but I just want to talk about this real quick. It was about the resurrection, and it was kind of one of those things where the topic of the lesson was, how do we know that the resurrection actually happened? So many people say, well, this could have happened. There's so many hypotheses of like conspiracy theories of, well, that Jesus wasn't actually resurrected on the third day. But it's like each and every one of those, you can prove those wrong. But nobody can really prove the resurrection story wrong with any evidence whatsoever. And there's all kinds of evidence. This just really interests me, and I hope it does you too. First of all, in the Bible, there's four ancient biographies of Jesus. They're all written by eyewitnesses, four different guys, written and circulated while many other eyewitnesses were still alive. They all say that he rose from the dead. Not only that, pagan writers, Jewish writers, they all report that Christians believed Jesus rose from the dead. So you establish that fact. But here's the thing. Many of the principal eyewitnesses to the resurrection of Jesus died because of their claim. They stood by it, and they ended up being killed as martyrs, whatever it was. Their lives would have probably been spared if they recanted. That's very significant. We know people will die for a cause, but these men and women, they died for a set of facts. They went to their grave rather than saying, hey, this is not true. They died because they stood by the facts of the crucifixion that they saw. Now, the story we mentioned earlier, the one told by John, is very important. Many people today claim John's story, it's meant to be understood as a symbol rather than a metaphor. But we know that John clearly understood the difference between telling a historical story and telling a story overflowing with symbol and metaphor. Well, how do we know that? Well, he wrote two books, one that very clearly claims to be historical, and that's the Gospel of John, and one that very clearly is all about symbol and metaphor, and that's the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. So John's an important witness of what happened in the death and the resurrection of Jesus. The evidence shows that the grave was empty, the grave cloths were left behind, we talked about that earlier, and the stone that enclosed the tomb was rolled away. The body of Jesus was never found, they never did find it. And while Jesus was in the tomb, it was guarded by Roman soldiers, but nobody ever claimed to have stolen the body. And we talked about the grave cloths that were there, how that was significant. And there were actually, not counting Paul, 11 recorded times that Jesus appeared to people, proving that he was resurrected. The appearances were to men and women, individuals, couples, groups, and at least one big crowd. The appearances were inside and outside, different locations, different times of the day. He was physically touched by Thomas. We know that story. He was audibly heard, visually seen. He ate food in the presence of witnesses. And here's the thing, none of the witnesses believed that Jesus would rise from the dead before it happened, but all of them knew him before his death, so they knew he was the same Jesus who died on the cross. Even the Jewish writers at the time, the people who put Jesus to death, their writing was that the tomb was empty. They did admit that, but the body couldn't be accounted for. And you got to think, it eventually would have turned up. I mean, in that day and time, in that area, not as many options, someone would have found it. I truly believe that. In this very place where Jesus died and was buried, there was an explosion of growth in the Christian movement, which was centered around the claim that the grave was empty and that Jesus truly had risen. And that big explosion of growth that happened just weeks after he died and was resurrected in the place where he died. The growth happened in the face of hostility, opposition, persecution from civil and religious leaders. And so at the end of the day, the death and the resurrection of Jesus wasn't a random event. It didn't just happen out of nowhere. He said it was going to happen. He said how it would happen. And he said what would happen afterward. His prediction was that he would die from crucifixion. And that's also significant. He couldn't control that. He claimed that his death by crucifixion and his resurrection on the third day would be a sign that vindicated who he was and what he taught and what he would accomplish by his death and resurrection. And here's the thing, this happened thousands of years ago, but yet this story is still around and it's still huge. It's still the biggest religion in the world. So many things have come and gone, but yet Jesus and the story of Christ and the resurrection still remains, and it still can't be proven untrue. And I tell you this too, if you're a Christian, you know what I'm saying here, but if you're not, I highly encourage you to ask Jesus into your heart as your personal Lord and Savior and experience the peace that comes with believing in Jesus Christ, and it will be the best decision you ever make for all of eternity. I guarantee that one. And that brings me to this week's verse of the week, Romans 5:8. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. What does it mean that Christ died for us? It means that he died in our place. Because of our sin, we deserve to suffer God's angry judgment. We deserve the death. Christ took that judgment for our sin on himself on the cross. He suffered and died in our place. And what Paul is saying here is that we should take that act as evidence of God's great love for us. Jesus died in our place before we even knew we would want him to do that. He died in our place before we'd ever done anything to deserve that love. It takes a lot of love to willingly die for somebody else, even if they're a good person. But we, those who have been saved, we're still sinners, and we weren't going to improve. In truth, we had no hope of avoiding God's judgment before Jesus took it for us. God proved his love for us, and that makes him more trusting. That's going to do it for the Good Cheer program this week. I hope you were blessed by the program. Until next week, I'm Chauncey Griffith, and God loves you. He really does. Bye-bye for now.
How many times must we see the blue sky before we will believe? How many days must we see a sunrise before God's grace we receive? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many times must a rainbow appear before God's mercy we feel? How many songs must a robin have to sing before we know that God is real? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many times must the rain start to fall before we look up to pray? How many years must the flowers start to bloom before our fears are washed away? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How long must creation exist before we will understand that the Bible was written by the wind of God, and that Jesus became a man? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer 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 is blowing in the wind.